find all sorts of opinions and add your own at the Radio National website.
Yes, does that sound familiar? Even if you weren't there or weren't born yet, somehow the Aquarius Festival lives on in Australia's collective memory, doesn't it? It's the 40th anniversary of that countercultural curiosity this week, and people are gathering in Nimbin, New South Wales again to mark it, as you'll hear on the show today. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Welcome to Laugh Matters. Lovely to have you with us. Well, first, though, it's relevant, perhaps, to mention that in some alternative lifestyle communities like the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales, there have been reports of child vaccination rates dropping, with diseases making a comeback that shouldn't be, like whooping cough. This morning, RN Breakfast looked at New South Wales legislation being proposed to allow childcare centres to refuse enrolment if children haven't received their shots. And if you grew up in the era where babies and children routinely died from the horror of measles or pertussis or succumbed to polio, then you know firsthand what a difference population-wide vaccination programs have made. This is a really delicate issue to talk about publicly, especially in the media. Let's acknowledge that, with the real issue that if you give oxygen to select or perhaps rational anxieties, vaccination rates will drop, impacting all of us. So is it ever possible to have a measured conversation about concerns given what's at stake? Well, multi-award-winning science filmmaker Sonia Pemberton has gone where few others dare to tread in a carefully considered doco called Jabbed, Love, Fear and Vaccines, which will screen this Sunday night on SBS. Welcome, Sonia.
Hello, Natasha. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And thank you for being with us. And also joining us on the line from the US is John Salamone. John features in the documentary, as do a number of parents. He became a lobbyist for safer vaccines after his own son had, well, an extremely rare reaction to the polio vaccine. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And also with us in the studio is Julie Leask. She's Associate Professor at the University of Sydney School of Public Health and a Senior Research Fellow at the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance of Vaccine Preventable Diseases. My God, what a title. Welcome, Julie.
Indeed. Hi, Natasha.
Thanks for being with us. Sonia, I'll start with you. The issue of vaccinations and parental anxiety of side effects is one to tread extremely careful with. As a science journalist and filmmaker, why did you want to go there with this film?
Well, you're quite right, Natasha. It's kind of intimidating, this one. I became interested in this because I made a film that went on the ABC a few years ago called Catching Cancer, and it dealt with the HPV, the human papillomavirus vaccine, and cervical cancer prevention. And I received quite a lot of mail after it, most of it pretty good, but some of it was really quite harsh and quite critical. And it started me thinking. I couldn't quite figure out why people were so afraid of or nervous around this vaccine. And I'm aware of my own biases. I mean, I come from a medical family. I make science films.
Not your average medical family, we should acknowledge. I mean, your father's a retired head of neonatology at Princess Margaret Hospital in Perth. Your grandfather started the International Epidemiology Association back in the 50s.
Yeah, I grew up at a dinner table that said, justify your position. Every time you said something, you had to have the data, the facts, the publication to justify whatever it was you were saying. So from a young age, this was the discipline, I guess, I was exposed to. And I'm very grateful for it because it means that I'm fairly comfortable looking at things from multiple points of view. And I guess that is the whole point of Jabbed. I was alerted to this sense of disquiet, if you like, concerns that were out there, questions that were out there. And it started me thinking, it started me wondering why people were nervous around the vaccines. I just assumed that they were sensible, good things because they stopped diseases. So basically that started a 2.5 year journey of really seriously looking at this issue and trying to figure out if a film could contribute, because that is an if, you know, a film can make things worse. Julie has been very helpful with me, helping me with this, and as have other experts, but guiding me about what are the useful things to contribute in terms of a public debate or public conversation. I must admit, I don't like that word debate. One of the strongest things I have at the moment is a sense that it's not a debate. You know, it should be a conversation.
I think we need to be clear that this is not a film that promotes the anti-vaccination perspective. I think we need to say that up front. But in looking at individual, extremely rare cases where something has gone wrong in association with or after a vaccine, correlation is questionable in some cases, there is a risk that people will overinterpret the risks. And this is dangerous in terms of, you know, public health communication.
Yeah, absolutely. But my argument, if you like, was that people are finding this information on the internet anyway. You Google vaccines, you're going to find these stories. And I spent 2.5 years digging down into these stories. The vast majority were unverifiable rumours. The absolute vast majority were people claiming things where there was no way of checking, no way of finding out it was true. So I kept going until I could find these cases where parents would put their names to their claims, and I could find them and I could talk to them and I could look into the medical science behind what they thought had happened to their child. And I quickly got a picture that the cases are incredibly rare. But they are real, and that was a shock. And that was the point at which I went, okay, there is something to contribute here. The important thing to notice is that they are rare and that they have reasons behind them, not all of which we understand, but we are increasingly understanding. And the other issue was I didn't want... I keep seeing these reports that the scientific community aren't doing anything about these concerns or aren't doing anything about these rare adverse reactions, and they are, and I wanted to show that.
Okay, well, we'll come to John in just a moment, but I just want to come to Julie Leask. Your own research has looked really closely at the psychological and social aspects of vaccination and, I guess, controversy around vaccinations. Let's get the Australian picture straight here, Julie. To what extent are vaccination rates really on the decline in some regions of Australia? Because you've got some concerns about how that's played out in the media and what the specifics actually are.
Yes, I do. Look, the first thing to remember is that our immunisation rates in Australia are actually quite high, and they're holding steady nationally. Over time, they're not declining. And in fact, in the four-year-old age group, they're increasing slightly. So that's a good news story. You know, the cup is more than half full. They're nationally, 8% of children are not up to date with all their vaccines. It's not like they haven't had any. Most of them have had some. They just need to get up to date. Only 2% of parents won't vaccinate their children willingly because of their concerns about vaccine safety, a general belief system around health.
Only 2%. But if you looked at the kind of geography of that, are they clustered in particular regions?
They are, and that's the concern. So if you do have disease outbreaks in those regions, that those communities are more vulnerable to those outbreaks. It doesn't mean that the communities where immunisation rates are higher are completely not vulnerable at all. They can be. It's a complex issue. And what I like about Jabbed is that Sonia's explored the complexities of this. She's looked into the positives of vaccination. She's taken a very powerful look at what vaccines can prevent. And she's not shied away from risk and recognised that in very, very rare instances, there can be serious side effects. And I think the vast majority of Australians recognise that with most medicines, there are risks, but we take them because the benefits outweigh those risks.
It's how you have that public conversation about that risk, isn't it? And also you're very interested in how medical professionals have that conversation with individual parents in that waiting room, in that consult room.
I am. It's the cornerstone of public support for vaccination. We know that if health professionals are confident and competent and communicating well with parents, then the parents who bring their concerns to them will usually have their concerns allayed. And so what I think has become clear to me in 15 years of researching this area is that we do need to have a conversation with the community, which involves listening to individual parent concerns and responding to them appropriately. But remembering that actually, nearly 50% of Australian parents don't actually have any concerns about immunisation. They're happy to go ahead and do it anyway.
Well, there are degrees of concern, as your work illustrates. John Salamone, let me come to you there in the US. Now, your son is now 22. We meet David in Jabbed, the documentary. It's the first time, I gather, he's spoken himself publicly about his experience. He was a one in a million case. Tell us what happened to David that compelled you to become the lobbyist that you did.
Well, David had the normal series of vaccines when he was a baby. And unfortunately, after he had the polio vaccine, he had, in this case, it was the Sabin or the oral vaccine, the live virus, which was, you know, the dominant vaccine given in the United States back in 1990. When he was given that vaccine, he had a reaction. He had roseola, he had fever, and then within weeks, he became paralyzed from the waist down. He stopped crawling, and he very lethargic, and unfortunately, he contracted polio directly from the vaccine, and we found out later on that it was because he was born without half of his immune system, and we didn't know it.
Or he had a genetic immune disorder, didn't he?
Correct. And in fact, 25% of the children back then who got polio from the vaccine had an immune issue. And because, you know, keeping in mind you were giving the live virus and there was no way to for the body to respond appropriately to that if you have an immune issue. And so we went through the normal phases of grief and frustration, anger, and ultimately action when we found out that there was a safer vaccine available but just not distributed in the United States widely, and that was the injectable or the kill virus polio vaccine.
Yes, you really you decided to channel that grief and anger in a way that perhaps some parents would be surprised by. So you began to lobby the government not to ban the vaccine but to distribute a safer vaccine.
Exactly, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, it was part of the coping mechanism for my wife, Kathy, and myself to get involved in making the change so that no other child had to suffer what David suffered. And it's a cause that, you know, helped us deal with David's issues on a daily basis. So I got involved everywhere from the White House to the Congress to the CDC. I organized the families of other children with polio from the vaccine, and we basically marched on Atlanta in the CDC and in wheelchairs and crutches and stood before the CDC and made the case for the first time that they needed to make a change in the polio vaccine.
It took you many years to get a result, 10 years, I think. You did get the result that you want. So what polio vaccine is now available in America?
Exclusively the injectable or the killed vaccine is available now in the United States. Fortunately, in fact, there hasn't been, since that's happened, there hasn't been one case of vaccine-associated polio in the United States that I'm aware of.
Why did it take so long, do you think? And John, I wonder if people used your case to, I guess, promote an anti-vaccination point of view.
I'm sure, and I think the reason it took us a long time is because you have to look at the individual pediatrician. The vast, vast majority has never seen a case of polio. So in their mind, the idea that one could contract polio from the vaccine was just off the wall, you know, so rare that it wasn't worth thinking about. And so they got into the habit and the comfortable routine of giving that sweet liquid oral vaccine to their patients, and there was really no incentive for them to change a decade-long practice until they started to see the faces of the kids who were impacted by that policy. And what they thought, I think, it took a while because, you got a vaccine company that in the United States that produced the oral vaccine that had the exclusive, almost $300 million business. And I think there was a certain sympathy for the company not putting them out of business in that area quickly. So they allowed it to kind of be phased in, if you will. Mm. I've learned, you have to accept a half a loaf sometimes, and we were heading in the right direction. I knew we were going to get there, and so we had to be patient.
I can imagine, and also a very confusing terrain when people might be co-opting your campaign for their campaign against vaccinations. This morning on Life Matters, I'm joined by John Salamone, online from Virginia in the US. He became a lobbyist for a safer polio vaccine after his son David contracted polio from vaccines based on the live virus, or at least weakened virus. And Julie Leask is joining me too. She's an associate professor at the University of Sydney who researches, I guess, vaccinations and vaccination controversies. And also Sonia Pemberton, she's a science filmmaker, and her film Jabbed, Love, Fear and Vaccines is coming up this week. Sonia, back to you. What becomes clear in watching your film is that there are rare cases of children who have genetic disorders for whom vaccination is going to be a risk, and I guess for parents watching that might heighten their concern that their child might be one of those children. The key here, though, is this is where herd immunity plays a role, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a number of issues there, and this is incredibly complex, so pardon me if I go slowly, but there's one issue that we have vulnerable people in our community, vulnerable individuals, and they need protection from the diseases, perhaps more than most in some ways. So we've got to remember that vaccination is not just for us, it's for everybody. And the more people are vaccinated, we all know the line, the more the community is vaccinated. I think what the individual issues show us is that we have to pay attention to the individual stories because they give us signals, if you like, that there might be something going on. In John Salamone's case, you know, that was a signal that there was a problem with the vaccine. There were more cases caused of polio in the US at that stage from the vaccine than the actual wild virus. So it was time to change. And what that shows us is that we can adapt as new science comes to light. And I guess that's the message, as a scientific filmmaker, that's the message I kind of want to communicate, is that science is not set in stone, medicine is not set in stone, human beings are not set in stone. You know, we have to watch, we have to listen, we have to observe.
And in some ways, the heat that surrounds the public discussion around vaccines and risk can sometimes not allow science to progress as it might because people
absolutely
become polarised.
Absolutely. And what John's case shows you is follow the science. Good activism is important. You know, parents paying attention to what's going on is important. Questioning the vaccines in the correct context, and by correct I mean when the science is there and the science is solid. I mean, we do obviously have the other cases that have been proven to be utterly and completely wrong, such as the autism debate, in inverted commas. We have to be careful. We have to actually use sensible thinking, logical thinking, and look at this and make a good judgment call. Now, I'm not putting myself forward as an expert or a vaccine advocate. I'm a filmmaker, and I've just spent 2 years, compared to Julie's 15 plus years and John's 20, 30 years, thinking about all these sorts of things. What I see is that we must pay attention. We must be open to having the conversation, because if we shut down the conversation and say, oh, this person's anti-vaccine and this person's pro-vaccine, it gives us no room to have a dialogue. And what I've discovered in the last couple of years is that there are lots of parents, as Julie said, that 92, 93% of Australians vaccinate. But within that group, there are a proportion, around about half, that have questions.
Although their questions, their questions might be rather undermined by seeing that opening footage in your film, incredibly difficult scene of a little baby with whooping cough.
Well, I mean, this is the issue. It is okay to be scared of the vaccines, but also don't forget to be scared of the diseases. And actually, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say it's all right to be scared of both. And the issue is, how do you determine the relative risk? And I think the science clearly shows that the evidence is on the side of the diseases.
Yes,
the diseases are unquestionably horrific. And I'm sorry if the opening sequence of the film is
tough.
Brutal.
Let me it is brutal, and it was a brave decision to do it, I think, but an important one. Julie Lisk, how are you listening to Sonia here, and how we have this public discussion? Because if you do nominate and give oxygen or give public airing to those cases, those rare cases of risk, there is a concern that parents will get anxious.
Look, I've looked at the impact of these sorts of messages on parents, and what's clear to me is that in our research, parents have a fundamental view to start with. It's not like you're coming into a blank slate. You know, we all have our views about vaccination, and the way the messages we get interact with those views. So you're not necessarily going to be put off vaccination by one documentary or by one particular message.
But if you look in the UK, there has been an absolute outbreak of measles currently, and that is quite categorically linked to the controversy and the fraudulent science that surrounded the MMR vaccine and its link with, you know, the fraudulent link that was made with autism.
And it took, that theory took 4, 5, 6 years for immunisation rates to really bottom out. It takes sustained exposure to that message. It starts to circulate in communities, in mothers' groups, and then it catches fire, sure. But generally, people support immunisation. It's actually hard to change their views. And they recognise that there are some risks. What parents are constantly doing, what we all do as parents in life, is weigh up risks and benefits. And I think most parents recognise that the benefits of vaccination, of protecting their children, outweigh the very small risks. But it's important to acknowledge those risks. And it concerns me that if we have an environment where we jump on anybody who expresses concern about risk, there might be an atmosphere where we don't listen as well. And Sonia's right, we have to listen, we have to look at these claims and investigate them thoroughly. I'm confident in Australia that that does happen pretty well.
John Salamone, let me come to you finally. What do you make of the vaccine politics in the US today?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not an expert on the politics today because we were successful a number of years ago with our effort. But I can tell you that there's still people out there who are anti-vaccine, who avoid their children getting the vaccine, and unfortunately, you know, they're taking big risks. I think that the one thing that we don't want to be perceived as being is anti-vaccine. I mean, if a parent of a child who had an adverse reaction to a vaccine can be a strong proponent of vaccines, then certainly everyone can understand the value of vaccines and the fact that if you don't get them, you're putting your children at risk.
Many more children have polio. How's your son David doing now in his 20s?
He's doing quite good. His birthday is next week. He'll be 23. He just started a position outside of Washington, D.C. with a computer company. He gets around. We're actually looking now to get him a new brace that might allow him to, for the first time in his life, run, which would be amazing. So we're very excited about that. He's doing well. He's a happy young man, and he's adjusted very well. And I think he's pleased about the role that he played in this film because for the first time in his 23-year life, he has spoken instead of my wife and I speaking on the subject. And so I think he's proud of the role that he played through his case of changing the vaccine policy in the United States and making it safer.
And I think it's quite clear that he's very proud of the role that you played too, as brave parents taking this on. Look, thank you to you all, and Sonia, thank you for the film. It's a nuanced look at some of these issues, but I have no doubt it'll inspire some interesting discussion on the website for the film. Thank you, Sonia Pemberton, science journalist and director of the film Jabbed, Love, Fear and Vaccines, coming up on SBS this Sunday. That's Sunday the 26th at 8:30 p.m. Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you.
And also to Julie Leask, Associate Professor at the University of Sydney in the School of Public Health. Yes, that's right, isn't
it? Correct.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Julie. And to John Salamone on the line from Virginia in the US. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And just a reminder then, that's Jabbed, coming up this Sunday on SBS at 8:30 p.m. And interested to hear from you on the effort that Sonia's made. Certainly after the film, get in touch and let us know what you think about the documentary. You're with Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell joining you this morning. And we're heading to the age of Aquarius next.
Hi, Waleed Ali here from RN Drive. As you might have heard, Australia's population recently hit the 23 million mark. And apropos of that, we're asking, how big do you want your Australia to be? RN Drive is presenting the second of RN's election issues forums, Big Ideas for Australia, Growing Pains, between 7 and 8 p.m. on Tuesday before a live audience. So join us for that special event here on RN Drive.
Well, the year was 1973, the month was May, and counting on all my fingers and toes, that makes it 40 years since the Aquarius Festival.
After several months of planning and 10 days of participation by up to 6,000 people, more than just a festival of the arts, the Aquarius Festival attempted to offer an alternative to what its proponents feel is an unsatisfactory way of life.
The nectar tastes so sweet, though.
There are very definite moral rules here, very definite norms. It's only a case that these are different norms than exist in the outside world. One case in point I might mention is at the swimming hole yesterday, where everybody swims in the nude, two girls came down dressed in bathing suits. Now, there's very strong disapproval of this among the people there. People stared at them quite openly because this was seen as not an in thing to do.
And he can show you too.
This is only a temporary sort of experiment. It's a temporary society. What happens when everyone goes back to the city?
Well, I don't think some of them will be going back. There's a lot who seem to think they'd rather start a community somewhere in the country and just have a few people involved. I'm sure the ones who go back must feel a little more community-minded just from being here and experiencing the effects of people not being community-minded too.
Light is shining around us, but it's up to you.
Yes, a couple of thousand happy folk landed in Nimbin in New South Wales for the countercultural Aquarius Festival 40 years ago. The slogan, I gather, was, "There is no program, you are the festival." It was organic in every sense of the word, I think. The festival celebrates 40 years this week with a two-day event, Aquarius and Beyond. And joining me with a big grin on his face listening to that audio, actually, is John Allen, a.k.a. Captain Culture, Captain with a K, Culture with a K. As he was known back in 73, he was the cultural director of the Aquarius Festival. And hopefully joining us shortly will be Dr. Rob Garbutt, who is lead convener of the Aquarius and Beyond Gathering this week from Southern Cross University. Welcome to Life Matters, John.
Thank you, Natasha.
Captain Culture. What a moniker.
Great man, isn't it?
Where did that come from?
Graham Dunstan and I, as my co-director, just sort of felt that we wanted to be a little bit less formal. So he became Superfest and I became Captain Culture, although occasionally we would reverse the roles.
And I think we've got Rob now, Dr. Rob Garbutt, who's lead convener of the Aquarius and Beyond Gathering this week from the School of Arts and Social Sciences at Southern Cross Uni. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for that, Natasha.
Nice to have you with us. I'm just, John, I mean, take us back and just come in a bit closer to the mic. That's great. Take us back, because this was not about emulating a Woodstock.
Indeed not. In fact, it was in opposition in some ways to Woodstock. What had happened is that the Australian Union of Students had already had a couple of Aquarius festivals. The one in 1971 on the ANU campus in Canberra caused quite a bit of fuss and bother.
I can imagine. The ANU and the 70s.
Yeah. Yes, and students going off and demonstrating at every embassy, etc. So the AUS decided that they wanted to go in a different direction. And Graham Dunstan and I had been sort of looking at the little humble festivals. I'd been doing it outside Gosford in outside Sydney, and saw another model there, that what in fact we could do would have a countercultural gathering, not a mini Adelaide festival, not a mini Woodstock, but something entirely new and something very Aussie.
Very Aussie.
I think very Aussie. A lot of it about sort of rediscovering the country towns that a lot of us had been born in, and rediscovering sort of, you know, the showground country culture that was part of
actually,
the Australian
Open. That's a lovely way of putting it, because Nimbin was doing it tough when the Aquarius Festival landed in it, didn't it?
It was indeed. It had featured on Four Corners early in the year as a dying town. The town had lost its hospital, was going to lose its school. In fact, the population was less in 1973 than it had been at the turn of the century. So it was a fortunate discovery, I think, for both AUS and for Nimbin. And one of our slogans was to, you know, to try and revitalise the country town.
Wonder what they thought of that, the locals, hey?
mixed feelings, I think.
What was the range of responses from the locals at the time? A bunch of, you know, ne'er-do-well students landing on their doorstep to offer them a countercultural, you know, smorgasbord salvation.
I think the full spectrum from delighted and embracing to, you know, to scowling and anti, and probably still is to this day.
There was no program, you know, a couple of thousand people, although sometimes I think the word was there were 10,000. I don't think it was quite that
probably
many.
Probably two or three is closer.
Bigger in your mind, bigger in your consciousness, your collective consciousness.
Indeed, but, in your imagination.
That's right. What was crucial, though, John, was that this was to be an unstructured happening. How does that work without total chaos?
Well, I think total chaos was put embraces total chaos. I mean, we didn't just say there's no program, you are the festival. We spent a good year or so energetically going from campus to campus and to communities, talking to people about how we wanted them to come to the festival, how we wanted them to make their life an art form and to celebrate their life. So talking about the structures that they would build, how they would go about communicating with others. There's a lot of networking.
It was a movement, really, rather than a festival.
It was, really, yes.
But I think that sort of national tour that you did in the lead-up to the Aquarius Festival included some real characters. Spike Milligan, was that true?
Yes, it was actually a number of tours, because I was running a circuit around the Australian universities, and we were trying to not just talk kind of rock and roll and entertainment, we were trying to seed a few ideas. So Spike was one of them. Spike was an amazing man, because he wasn't just a great comedian. He was very much on about environmentalism and very much on about mental health, two issues which were to come to the fore, you know, as the years went on.
Yeah.
So he was a great, you know, great speaker and raconteur. We also toured Ralph Nader, Ivan Illich, various people that had some ideas to contribute. And that was part of getting Nimbin together, going around the campus circuit sort of week after week, gathering people together and saying, hey, we've got this great idea for a new kind of festival. Come and join us.
So 40 years on, Rob Garbutt,
yeah.
Aquarius Beyond 2013. What's the impetus?
I guess there's a few things about the after. I guess one of the things was that it just seemed like in our region, up here in the Northern Rivers region, the festival itself was a real catalyst for change. And so it's just something worth marking. And as a university in the region, what we do is whole conferences. So that's what we thought we'd do. And, there was a range of people who were doing research in this area, which we thought we could bring together, as well as get some of the storytelling happening as well. So people who were there at the time and bring people who were there, researchers together, townsfolk who have lived through the last 40 years and have their reflections to talk about, young people who have been raised on intentional communities, and just have a chat about the past but also the future.
Yes, indeed, that linking of the two.
Absolutely.
How was it? Give some dimensions to how you see the Aquarius Festival 40 years ago being a catalyst for change in the region. What came of it? Because it's not always a pretty picture, but we'll come to that.
Sure. I guess there was a flowering of creativity in this region as a result. So there was, this idea of life being art also gave expression through all sorts of things. Artistic creation is one thing, but I guess also in terms of building and home building practices. So, for example, our regional gallery at the moment, as part of this same 40th anniversary, there's an exhibition on called Not Quite Square, about owner, builder and North Coast architecture that's come out of this time. Mm. We've got markets in the region that formed because of intentional communities that sprung up. So we've got one of the highest densities of intentional communities in Australia here. For a regional area, the cultural diversity of this region is quite amazing. And it may not have been just Aquarius that has done that, but it was certainly, it provided a fermenting chamber, yeah. for getting it all going. It was like the yeast.
That's right, and then there's the whole sort of tree change, sea change movement swelling of people that moved out of the cities.
And I think that some of the attraction of this region, Byron Bay, Nimbin, Moolambar, this sort of triangle of green and all, green air, this little area is one of the attractions is this abundance of various ways of living and being in the place. So.
But of course, Nimbin has seen some rough times and continues to as the population expanded off the back of the Aquarius Festival. And today, there is that reputation for Nimbin being a destination for drug peddlers.
Sure. And, I guess that's been one of the things that has been certainly put Nimbin in the news continually, I guess in that bad news sort of way. And that is one of the downsides for sure, from this time. But I think it's gone through, it sort of went through a low period through the 80s and 90s when there was a real heaviness to that drug scene. But since then, I think the thing that Nimbin is really becoming known for is the social experiment that's happened there with its experiments with alternative energy and sustainability and organic farming and all those sorts of things. So I guess there's there is a tension, though, between these two things, for sure.
Yeah, John, take us back then. Captain Culture, I should say. It's wonderful getting to relive that title, I imagine, 40 years on. But take us back to, I guess, that cultural ferment that Rob's describing there 40 years ago. I mean, music was a part of it, wasn't
music
it?
Music was very much a part of it. We really sort of tried to bring together a bit of a grandiose phrase, I guess, but the best minds of our generation. We would, as we were touring around the cultural circuit, we would identify anyone who was doing anything interesting, whether it was the latest macrobiotic restaurant or the latest interesting author, and we would invite them to come and have a chat about this festival. So it really was an attempt to gather together what we thought was, saw then as a revolutionary movement, and it was the beginnings of the sustainability movement, what we now talk of as indie music, etc. All those things had their beginnings around then.
And I noticed that Rob was mentioning buildings and those kind of the innovation around intentional communities and buildings, and there were architecture students very much involved in the Aquarius Festival.
Indeed, it was the architecture students from Sydney and New South Wales universities under their tutors that had agreed to provide all the systems for the festival, and they took that as an opportunity to explore sort of geodesic domes and bamboo structures and every kind of innovation that you could imagine.
Have you maintained a relationship with the region? I mean, how has your life proceeded after that massive event that you co-curated.
I guess that all of us that were there sort of, you know, saw it as an important sort of pivot in our lives and in a sense as a spiritual home. So I've gone back to Nimbin many times, have close friends up there, and looking forward this week to, interesting that 40 years later, a whole bunch of people from all around the country are still happy to descend on Nimbin once more with a sense of camaraderie. I think it was an important sort of high point in many of our lives.
Not a lost dream? It won't be a festival of lost dreams,
oh, look,
partly?
I suppose in some
ways.
Is
that a bit brutal?
Probably a bit brutal, but in some ways quite true. lost dreams, but also sort of, as Rob said, I think the important thing now is where does this go into the future? Mm. And what I'm really pleased about the fact that Rob and Southern Cross have got involved, it's time, I think, to sit back and evaluate a little bit and say, well, kind of, you know, after, you know, 40 years on, did this have any import? Important significance? If so, what was it? And how does it work into the future? Because it'll be the grandchildren of Aquarius that carry it into the future.
And looking at the program of the Aquarius and Beyond gathering on Thursday and Friday, it's very much about those contemplations. Rob, final question to you. How are locals going to be involved? Just briefly.
Well, locals will be involved by coming along. We've also got some panels of locals who are talking about their experiences. And it's part of our ongoing research, really. This isn't just something for this year, but it's an ongoing research project into the counterculture in this region and its place in Australian history. So we're really interested in the way that the straight side of town, if you like, has both embraced the alternate and experienced this change as well.
Oh, interesting juxtaposition there.
Absolutely.
Probably an interesting hybrid identity that came of it all,
I suspect, for
the people in the region.
It's not two sides anymore of this. There's a big spectrum of people and practices that we've all become, they've all become part of our daily lives, and we're often unaware of some of these changes that have happened.
Look, thank you very much to you both. I hope it's a fantastic week. Enjoy journeying to the region, the beautiful Northern Rivers region. And thank you for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Thank you, Natasha. I'm sure it will be.
Thanks, Natasha.
John Allen, a.k.a. Captain Culture, and he giggles every time I say that. Dr. Rob Garbutt, lecturer in cultural studies at Southern Cross University. And perhaps you're going. And if you are, please get in touch and report back as to how the Aquarius and Beyond Festival proceeded. And Robin on Twitter writes, was 14 and worked at a health food shop in Lismore when the Aquarius Festival was in Nimbin. Lots of great people came in, and it sounds like Nimbin is about to have lots of great people descend again, old and new. And up next, our modern dilemma for this week. Stay tuned for that one.
I really wanted to hear about this mythical place where people are either pregnant, dying, or promiscuous.
Now hear this. Now available as a podcast.
We were in the trough of a wave, and I looked behind me, and there was this wall of water that was taller than the mast.
Now hear this. Listen online anytime at the RN website. And you too can be part of Now Hear This. Find all the details of the next storytelling slam at the RN website.
I think there's a huge issue here.
I can't... Yeah, I struggle with it, to be honest.
It's like walking a tightrope.
You might feel it's the right thing to do.
How I should say something.
There is a conflict.
I would tend to check that.
I'm muddled on this.
I really struggle with it.
And so to our modern dilemma for this week. One listener recently wondered about the prospects of becoming a single parent and how much to involve her partner. It absolutely sent the phone lines, the Facebook, everything, set it all on fire, I have to say. And in fact, the dilemma that's been given to me this week also concerns an unplanned pregnancy, it seems, but in a different context, the result of a casual affair. And the Life Matters listener, who we'll call Unsure, wrote to us with this. Recently, I was in a friends with benefits friendship. The idea of becoming pregnant never crossed my mind, and it took steps to avoid this happening. One night after too many drinks, contraception was not used at the time, and so I took the morning after pill the next day, which according to the instructions was meant to work within the first 24 hours. Unexpectedly, it did not work, and I fell pregnant, and then was faced with the dilemma of keeping the baby. I had two abortions many years previous, and made a promise to myself I would never put myself in this situation again. and if faced with pregnancy, I would have the baby. I'm in a position mentally, physically, financially, I could have a child. Not only this, I feel it has a special, it is a special thing to be pregnant and feel a deep connection with the life force growing inside me. However, the would-be father is refusing to have anything to do with the pregnancy and with me, and I feel immense pressure to make a decision based on what effect this would have on his life, being his DNA, and what my father would think of me for going ahead with the pregnancy. My other close family and friends are very supportive. My question is, who is it up to when making a decision to keep a pregnancy in a situation like this? That is, consider the father in this process. And what is the justification for this? Thank you very much, Unsure, for your dilemma. And one day I hope that we get a similar letter from a chap, a father in this situation. Please send them in if you can. I'd like to turn this one over to our guests, philosopher Dr. Patrick Stokes and psychologist Dr. Doris McIlwain. Welcome to you both.
Morning, Natasha.
Patrick from Deakin Uni and Doris from Macquarie University. Look, Doris, a friends with benefit friendship. This doesn't sound like a friendship at the moment.
No, I was thinking that myself, because the discussion that you would expect to occur between friends is really not happening. He seems to have walked away from the friendship. And I suppose that raises the question that, you know, is the primordial question, do sex and friendship mix in a sense?
Do they?
Well, it doesn't seem to here, does it? It seems as though there's sort of like vulnerabilities, differing templates of what's involved here. There's not really... I mean, this woman has not really been a sperm stealer. It's not as if she's had sex with a man knowing that she's unprotected and he believes she's protected, and she's done that just knowingly so that she can walk away and have the child on her own.
And that happens? And that happens?
Yes, it does seem to be, I would say. I mean, I've certainly heard of instances from young men who've been in that situation,
yes.
For instance, yeah. But it does seem to be an innocent mistake, doesn't it? And so one would imagine that if it's friendship, that he'll be in there discussing. They both knew they were going to, you know, they were having sex without protection. I mean, they're grown-ups, they know pregnancy's a possibility, and yet it's not happening.
It's not happening, Patrick. And these friendships, which include sex but with no strings attached, it's perhaps not always that straightforward, even though you'd like it to be.
Probably not. It is interesting that when you talk about sex in the context of a friendship, we had this idea that, well, we can do that. We can simply disentangle these things. We've gotten past the point of believing that sex without love is somehow inherently deficient, either morally deficient or experientially deficient. But at the same time, it seems like sex does involve kinds of vulnerability and kinds of openness and kinds of trust, which do actually go beyond what you would experience in normal friendship. And that does, I think, change things. It does complicate things in ways that maybe we can't predict ahead of time.
Yeah, Patrick, she Unsure is trying to do... you can hear her trying to do the right thing for both herself and the potential father. But perhaps she's going to struggle finding that middle ground on this one.
Sure, and it's very much to her credit, I think, that she's thinking about the father in this. She has at least three people whose interests she has to consider in this. She has to consider her own, she has to consider the father's, and she has to consider the child. Now, she asks, who is it up to in terms of continuing the pregnancy? And that's actually quite easy. It's up to her. It's really up to Unsure. And any of the arguments that you could use to justify ending a pregnancy also, I think, also entail that she has the call as to whether or not to do that, and don't give him the option to do that. But he has apparently chosen that he doesn't want to be this child's father.
But also doesn't seem to want to be her friend anymore.
No, and that's obviously incredibly distressing, but whether a friendship can survive an event like this is a tricky one. I mean, it would be nice to think that friendships can always survive every kind of thing you can throw at them, but they're not. They're messy human affairs, and messy human affairs are often fragile and vulnerable in that way.
Yeah, they sure are. Doris, what do you think of our listeners' attempt to consider her partner's point of view, her former partner's point of view?
Yes. Well, look... I sort of see a sort of a tentativeness in the way that she's addressing the concerns of others, not only the father-to-be and the ethics of keeping his DNA and his views, but also her own father's views. it seems as though there's perhaps concerns around shame or the father's judgment, and it might be that the father doesn't see sole parenting as a good thing in her family, or perhaps the father would judge the nature of the relationship in which the pregnancies occurred. And so, you know, she's very much trying to take seriously the fact that she's had a pregnancy with someone who isn't consensually being the father. But he has walked away, so I actually agree with Patrick. I think she is free to decide what she'd like to do, but I do also agree with Patrick that you've got to sort of think of this child who will be told at some stage of the father's attitudes to the child's conception. And I think that's quite a lot for a kid to cope with.
It is. It's a lot for anyone to cope with, parents included.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patrick, I wonder too whether if she did decide to go ahead with the child, you know, the situation for the father might not be categorical. Mm. She might have to renegotiate the situation when dad realises, my God, this is my offspring, I would like to have a role, you know, and she needs to be open to that possibility.
She does, and this is one of the interesting things about the notion of being a parent. It seems in this case like he's saying, well, I don't want to be a father. But, of course, there's another sense in which, well, he's going to be a father whether he wants to or not. And what that points to is that the very concept of a parent is both a biological and an emotional concept.
Mm.
And those two things often go together, but they can sometimes come apart. And a lot of us, I think, would want to say, well, really, it's the emotional stuff that matters. That's what makes you a parent. It's you know, doing the 3 a.m. nappy changes and, you know, doing all of the, you know, 2 in the morning bail calls when they're 15, all that sort of thing. That's what makes you a parent.
Personal experience.
No. We're nowhere near that yet. We're still at the 2 a.m. nappy changes. But,
yeah.
but it'd be interesting. People like me might want to say that. It's the emotional stuff that matters. But some philosophers, particularly somebody like David Velleman, who's at New York University, he's argued, well, if biology didn't matter at all, if it was all just a matter of emotional connection, why does Luke Skywalker get so upset when he finds out that Darth Vader's his father?
Yeah.
Why does he not just say, you know, oh, well, you know, you're not really my father. You never played kick to kick with me, or space kick to kick, or whatever.
Mm.
you know, you're not really my father. He does get upset. And what Velleman has argued, and some other philosophers have argued, is maybe biology matters more than we might think. And some have argued that, in fact, children have some kind of right to know about their biological heritage, because to a certain extent it does actually sort of ground us in the world, and it does explain a lot of things about us. There's a lot of tensions here that Unsure is going to have to negotiate over the years to come. But fortunately, it sounds like she's already doing this in a very interestingly thoughtful sort of way. So I think that bodes well.
Yeah. Doris, I mean, you're very interested as a psychologist in the way in which our emotional engagement with the world is also inextricably linked to our body. I just wonder, that's all sort of relevant to your work and research interests, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you can sort of see the sort of tacit signs of her embodiment in the dilemma. And I, you know, I just have to remark, you know, I love the way that she phrases it, the dilemma of keeping the baby.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other side to it. I think in her heart of hearts, you know, there's a sense in which at the level of her own body, the decision's already made. You can sort of see how she's thinking about the pregnancy in the language she uses as a life force. It's already as a baby. She feels a deep connection. And she's got that past pact with herself, which she made around what her body had experienced in her prior experiences of termination. So,
yeah.
So look, there's a certainty at the level of embodiment, but she's tentative at the level of the more social, emotional decision making, because she's really wanting to factor in the concerns of others. And I suppose, you know, I agree with Patrick that biology does matter, and with Velleman, because you know, this child would have to know who the father was, or might accidentally end up marrying his sister or, you know, her brother at some, you know, chance meeting further down the track. I mean, we do need to know, you know, how we're born wired to survive and
yes.
what we bring with us.
Well, I mean, just to finally to both of you, what should she, and beautiful remarks, I think, what might help her at this point? I mean, I wonder whether she actually needs to sit down with a professional at this point. Patrick?
probably wouldn't hurt, no. And I think she's going to need a hell of a lot of support anyway. That's a given, whatever she chooses to do here. So, yeah, certainly getting some sort of support like that would be good. I think the note for her long-term is going to be openness and flexibility. I think that's really how she's going to have to manage this. She's in a situation that is not one for which we have a ready-made script, and she's going to have to sort of make a lot of this stuff up as she goes along. That's okay. Most of us do that most of the time anyway without realizing we're doing it. So I think she's going to be okay. I think she's asking the right questions, but she is going to need some support.
Doris, I don't have time to come back to you, but I think you'd probably agree.
Absolutely, and include the father in that discursive process. Bring him along as far as is possible.
Oh, that's a very strong point to end on. Thank you for making that, Doris. Mm-hmm. Look, to both of you, Dr. Patrick Stokes, philosopher at Deakin University, Doris McIlwain, Dr. Doris McIlwain, a psychologist at Macquarie University, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
Once again, the wonderful wisdom of our Modern Dilemma guests. And please get in touch if you've got one. I really want to hear from you, and they can be personal, political, social. You name it. Michael Cathcart.
Natasha.
Got any dilemmas? I think you've got a controversy.
Got a controversy. Well, we're talking to David Sale, who created controversy in the past. He's a TV writer. He was the creator of Number 96, which I suppose seemed a kind of trashy soap opera at the time. Massively popular, of course, but maybe it was a more influential show than we might have realised. And he was also a writer on the Mavis Bramston show. So two very controversial and influential programmes.
Good one. Bit of nostalgia on Books and Arts Daily. We're getting nostalgic next on Life Matters. I wonder who'll be popping in. Stay tuned. Coming to the news.